Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here with you. Really appreciate the lovely special music. We were definitely in cahoots on this one, as they say. Picked the music to go with the message. A very good intro for the topic that we'll cover. I really appreciated Mr. Nitzberg's message as well. Very timely also. So in his message, he pointed out that being righteous is not the same as being perfect. And in the song, it was stated, I need time to grow into the strongest me, and that's where we'll pick up for this message. So we all know what it feels like to miss out on something. Maybe it's an opportunity, such as a membership in a group, a spot on a team, or maybe landing a school acceptance or a job offer. Maybe it's an experience, such as an enjoyable event with family or friends, or a trip that you were looking forward to. Maybe it's a relationship, a connection that you had wanted to make and weren't able to, or a connection that you had that came to a premature end. Missing out on things is one of those necessary realities of life that we don't really get to choose whether we'll experience or not. At times it may involve choices that we make, but just as often the outcome of missing out is at least partially beyond our control. Many of these occurrences are disappointing and disheartening for a brief time that quickly fades into insignificance, but others may reverberate through our lives for months or years. The experience of missing out on various aspects of life is so common, and the desire to avoid it so pervasive that missing out has its own pop culture syndrome, complete with an overused acronym, FOMO, the fear of missing out. We often use this with some humor and some exaggeration, but it describes a very real feeling of not wanting to miss an experience or an opportunity. We can feel this way for all kinds of things, good and bad. And there are healthy desires to not miss out. And the author of Hebrews makes a profound statement regarding one of them, something in life that we should be careful to not miss out on. That admonition is very relevant for us now as we prepare for Passover. Let's go to Hebrews 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And this section, starting in verse 12, is focused on persisting against the headwinds of life, headwinds that can cause us to be distracted or discouraged or other things that take us away from the journey. Hebrews 12, verse 12, the author writes, "Therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord." Verse 15, "Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God." For the remainder of this message, let's spend a bit of time to increase our understanding of this phrase. What does it mean to fall short of the grace of God? How can we avoid that very undesirable outcome? The answer, as we dig into it, is really quite encouraging. As we begin to explore the meaning of this admonition, it's important to remind ourselves of what God's grace is. We've had several sermons since the introduction of our booklet on the subject of grace, including Mr. Vinson's recent and helpful sermons on that topic. In our booklet, at the end of the section titled, "How Grace Reconciles Us to God," this summary statement is made. It says, "A good way to describe God's grace is as his freely given, undeserved favor toward us, motivated by his love and concern for us." So an undeserved favor that's motivated by love and concern. As the booklet explains in detail, grace is both an undeserved pardon and favor that confers a status or a treatment that we have not earned, and the giving of physical and spiritual gifts that enable us to transform away from and beyond the things that we have been pardoned from. Since grace is a freely given gift that cannot be earned, what does the author's warning and encouragement here in Hebrews mean to avoid falling short of it? In the Blue Letter Bible's interlinear concordance, the Greek word hystereo, translated as fail in the King James and fall short in the New King James, has the connotation of having fallen behind, as in one who falls back and doesn't reach a goal that they pursued, or one who comes late and is not present at an intended time. William Barclay's New Daily Study Bible translation of this passage is, "Watch that no one misses the grace of God, that no one misses it." This wording brings a very important perspective that has a bit of a different connotation than the New King James Version's fall short. The words fall short usually imply either not being capable of something that we should be or not having earned something that we could have. But grace, like salvation itself, is a free gift that does not depend either on our capability or on what we have earned. We can take a lot of encouragement in that understanding that we won't fall short of grace by not being capable or by not earning it. A more accurate way to think of it is that God's grace, at the timing he chooses for each individual, becomes both fully available and fully revealed through his calling. So if we miss out on grace, it will not be because we are incapable or unworthy. By definition, someone who is capable and worthy doesn't need the grace to begin with. The danger is in not accepting what is offered and missing out because we've chosen to opt out. There's both an individual and a collective or a communal aspect to the author's admonition. Clearly, we have to be self-aware and diligent in monitoring and maintaining our own spiritual condition and relationships with God the Father and Jesus Christ. The same awareness and diligence expressed as outgoing love must, though, extend beyond ourselves as well. Barclay's commentary on the verse highlights this when it states, "The word used for miss in reference to God's grace might be paraphrased as failing to keep up with the grace of God." And then he goes on to say that the early Greek commentator Theophylact interprets this in terms of a journey of a band of travelers who every now and again check up. Has anyone fallen out? Has anyone been left behind while the others have pressed on in the journey? We know what it feels like to be in some kind of group activity, a road trip or taking your family to the zoo, or we're coming up to camp season, participating in camp as a staffer or a worker. There's a constant mental status check and head count that's happening. Is everyone still okay? Did we forget anyone? Am I still in the right place? Do I have everything that I'm supposed to and that I should be taken care of? It's a good illustration of the same type of awareness, both inward and outward, that's required in our spiritual journey. Barclay then references a prophecy from the book of Micah. The beginning of Micah 4 is very familiar as a millennial prophecy of God's government being established as the mountain of the Lord's house that is referred to, that is exalted above the hills. And this prophecy is paralleled in Isaiah 2. And while these prophecies and many others show God's restorative work with the end-time remnant of his people, they also in many ways very accurately describe the transformative work that God is doing with his first fruits now. So in that context, here in Micah 4, Micah's prophecy provides a beautiful description of God's commitment to us as he checks up and keeps tabs on us as we fall behind at different times through the course of life. Micah chapter 4, in the first portion of verse 6, and I'll be reading this from the English Standard Version. It says, in that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame. I will assemble the lame. The Moffat translation renders this portion of the verse as, I will collect the stragglers. I will collect the stragglers. When we're honest with ourselves, we're all stragglers at different times during our lives. We're all at times in danger of missing the grace of God. Very thankfully for all of us, it is in God's nature and character to look out for and to help those who are struggling. The Blue Letter Bible's interlinear concordance shows that the word translated lame in this verse could also be translated to limp, to limp. And that gives a pretty clear picture and implication of a substantial injury or impediment, something that impacts a person's fundamental well-being. The New American Standard Bible translates the relevant statement in verse 6 as, I will assemble those who limp and gather the scattered. Every one of us, again, have a few places within our physical, emotional, and spiritual makeup where we limp and struggle with impediments that we can't overcome without God's help. It's the same story for all of us, humanly manifested in many different ways. The patriarch Jacob's life was no different, but God caused the reality of the struggle to be exposed in a particularly clear way for him, and for all of us who can learn through his story. Jacob's story in the scriptures makes it clear that he was, like us, far from perfect. He experienced many difficulties, and he was already limping emotionally in many areas of life by the time that he had a very personal encounter with God, meaning the one who became Jesus Christ, as it's explained in our Church's Beyond Today Bible commentary. Let's go to Genesis chapter 32. Genesis 32. And this section of Genesis 32 is titled in my Bible, Jacob Wrestles with God. I'll again be reading this portion in Genesis from the English Standard Version. Genesis 32, starting in verse 22. The same night he, Jacob, arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. Now, the background of this story is that Jacob and his family were heading back to his homeland, and Esau, Jacob's brother, and quite a large company with Esau that Jacob was very concerned about were coming to meet Jacob and his family. Verse 23, he took them, his family, and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. Verse 24, and Jacob was left alone. There are times in life for all of us when we feel like we're facing the uphill climbs and headwinds of life on our own. As the lyrics of a song by the folk rock artist, the Abbott Brothers, have it, even though I know there's hope in every morning song, I have to find that melody alone. It is often during such times that God steps into our solitude, come alongside us, bringing whatever it is that we specifically need to traverse that particular intersection in life. Continuing in verse 24, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Jacob encountered a prerequisite that is true for all of us in a very unique way. Ultimately, no matter what other relationships in life we have to come to terms with God individually in our own relationship with him. Jacob experienced a lot of first and second hand interaction with God, but there was still a deeper connection to be developed in his relationship with him. Commentators and those who have personal experience in the sport of wrestling point out the level of exhaustion that develops in just a matter of minutes from the strain and exertion of a physical struggle against another person when you're in the sport of wrestling. In this encounter, Jacob's tenacity to wrestle throughout the night as he did and his refusal to opt out on the struggle is a great illustration of the mindset that relationship commitment requires. Continuing in verse 25, "And when he saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for the day has broken.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.'" And these verses are easy to kind of read over again without grasping the full context. So try to put yourself in this scene, experiencing what Jacob did. You've been physically contending against somebody who's stronger than you through the night, some of that time with an injury that generates constant pain. No doubt he was exhausted, sweaty, fatigued, desperate for food and water. He was holding on with every fiber of being and refusing to give up. And it's in that physically and emotionally wrung out state that Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The statement was no doubt filled with earnest and genuine passion, driven by a refusal to believe that this draining experience was for nothing, that it was for no purpose. This encounter dramatically illustrates that despite many weaknesses and limitations that constantly hinder us, perseverance and persistence in the pursuit of any relationships, blessings, are the key characteristics that allow us to apprehend those blessings over time. Continuing in verse 27, "And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then he said, 'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and men and have prevailed.'" The word translated "prevailed" at the end of verse 28 is important because it means both to endure difficulty and to have power, strength, and the ability to accomplish. These two qualities are not separable in our character. Acceptance of the undesirable is required to achieve the outcome that we're pursuing. The Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius famously wrote, "The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way." So it was for Jacob and is for us. The struggles that impede us become the mechanisms that develop capability within us. The obstacles that expose our weaknesses become the paths where we develop the strength to overcome. And in the context that we're discussing here, the capability and strength that we're talking about isn't purely physical by any means, and certainly isn't self-reliant or self-sufficient. Much to the contrary, we're talking about spiritual maturity and the godly character that is forged during the transformation process. Paul describes this in Romans 12:2 as the renewing of our minds that allows us to prove that God's will is good and acceptable and perfect in our lives, not just in a detached theory or in other people's lives, but in the life that is personal and unique to us. Continuing in verse 29, "Then Jacob asked him, 'Please tell me your name.' And he said, 'Why is it that you ask me my name?' And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.'" In this statement, Jacob's words "and yet" express the critical element of God's incredible mercy and grace that we are focusing on today. He sees us and fully knows us, good and bad. As the traditional marriage vows say, his love continues for better or for worse. He fully knows us, and yet our lives are delivered by his love and the merciful atonement of Christ's sacrifice. Verse 31, "The sun rose upon him," Jacob, "as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip." The word limping here is the same word translated as lame in Micah 4. I will assemble the lame. I will assemble, collect, gather those, God says, who are limping physically, emotionally, spiritually. Like Jacob in this powerful illustration, we must wrestle on with whatever limps we have for as long as it takes to receive the blessing, to not endure the difficulty of the struggle for no reason, for no purpose. In these areas of our lives, we need the mindset illustrated in the very old tale from Aesop's Fables, The Hare and the Tortoise. In the Library of Congress's interactive online version of Aesop's Fables for Children, the legendary race is summarized as follows. It reads, "The hare was soon far out of sight, and he lay down beside the course to take a nap until the tortoise should catch up. The tortoise, meanwhile, kept going, slowly but steadily, and after a time passed the place where the hare was sleeping. But the hare slept on peacefully, and when at last he did wake up, the tortoise was near the goal. The hare now ran his swiftest, but he could not overtake the tortoise in time." There are many life lessons that can be drawn from this cautionary tale and many analogies and extensions on different topics that do just that. One of the most powerful lessons is a simple observation that the outcome for the hare was not due to his ability, but rather to his decision to lay down and take a nap, to do something other than keep going until he reached the end of the course. Likewise, and even more poignantly for our topic today, the outcome for the tortoise was also not due to his ability or lack of ability, but simply to his decision to keep plodding until the race was done. In the Apple Classics version of this fable, as retold by Anne McGovern, the unlikely hero's one pervasive strength is captured in this description of his strategy as the hare slept. Meanwhile, the tortoise plodded steadily on and on and on. Most of us stay on the right path when it's time to plod steadily on. Most of us then struggle mightily when it becomes and on and on. But that part of the journey is precisely and specifically what we've been called to. We need to both internalize and embrace it. One of the primary mechanisms that God has given us for doing exactly that is the annual process of personal evaluation in preparation for the Passover. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Starting in verse 23. Paul writes, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes.'" Verse 27, "Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup." It's easy to concentrate on that word, unworthy, and then internally assume that we need to become worthy. However, this phrase, unworthy manner, is not implying a state of worthiness that we can earn or fail to earn based on our spiritual capability. In the context of the whole passage where Paul is addressing a lack of respect for the profound meaning of the observance, the primary focus is actually on the word manner. The manner should be one of respect and reverence in our attitude and actions while we prepare for and then take the Passover. Our preparation should not be a frantic scramble to fix the things that are wrong in our lives with Passover as a kind of deadline. Rather, it should consist of an honest and open spiritual inventory that we take of ourselves, not anyone else. Galatians 6:4 says specifically that each one should examine their own work. It's not time to evaluate our spouse or our brother or sister or our friend. It's time to evaluate ourselves. When we do this together with God and Jesus Christ, we can see areas where we need improvement and the areas where we have improved. The purpose isn't just to heap up guilt for shortcomings, but to honestly know where we stand, both good and bad. The focus should be on continual improvement, the type described by poet Maya Angelou, who wrote, "I did then what I knew how to do. Now that I know better, I do better." There are several helpful ways to see this. Sometimes we simply aren't aware and don't understand. And once we do, we are equipped to do better in that area. In other areas of life, we already know better intellectually, but we haven't internalized what we know. In a specific period of my own life that I can remember, I did a lot of things that I intellectually knew better than to do. After I did them anyway and experienced the negative outcomes, I knew better in a much deeper and far more meaningful way. I listen pretty regularly to a podcast on a mix of financial and life and relationship topics, and I was struck recently by a response to someone who called in. A couple who called into the show were describing a series of mistakes and bad decisions they'd made that had left them in a pretty bad place, and how they were moving in a better direction by changing their mindset and their actions. And one of the hosts on the show asked an insightful question. He said, "For most of us, when we find ourselves in a bad place, our natural tendency is to look out and start shifting blame and responsibility to those around us. What sent you to the mirror instead? What sent you to the mirror instead?" That is exactly what this period of self-examination is meant to be, an annually commanded trip to the mirror where we see where we are now and recommit to continual improvement and transformation with God's help. In his book, Ego is the Enemy, Ryan Holiday writes about something he learned from studying the various outcomes for inmates who are incarcerated in prison for some period of time, and especially the differences between those who used the opportunity to change for the better and those who didn't. He writes, "The inmates who didn't improve themselves might have had nothing to do but think. It's just that what they chose to think about made them worse and not better. That's what so many of us do when we fail or get ourselves into trouble. Lacking the ability to examine ourselves, we reinvest our energy into exactly the patterns of behavior that caused our problems to begin with. And we can all see that in the mirror at some point in our lives. The opportunity to evaluate ourselves each year before Passover is really a gift, one that is intended to help us stay on a trajectory of improvement and overcoming and avoid the destructive cycles of thoughts and actions that put us on a trajectory of decline. Let's go back to Micah chapter 4. Back in Micah 4, we'll start again at the beginning of verse 6 and then keep reading. Micah chapter 4, verse 6. In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather those who have been driven away and those whom I have afflicted. And the lame I will make the remnant, and those who were cast off a strong nation. The Nelson Study Bible describes God's care for and ultimate elevation of those who are lame and scattered as, quote, a remarkable surprise of grace. Because of God's remarkable grace, we don't need to be anxious or fearful about missing out on his promises because we lack the ability to earn them. In Hebrews 12:15, where we started, we were instructed to watch and be vigilant, not to miss out on or fail to receive the benefits of that remarkable grace that make what we are able to earn irrelevant. The Expositor's Bible Commentary's explanation of this verse in Hebrews 12:15 state, God is not miserly in offering grace. He gives his people all they will take. Accordingly, it is important for them not to fail to make use of their opportunities. As we begin to wrap up, let's review a few encouragements from Paul's writings to take full advantage of grace's purpose in our lives. So there's actually three verses. It's mentioned in multiple places, and those multiple mentions usually signify an importance, an emphasis for importance on a particular topic. First, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15. Starting in verse 9, where Paul writes, "For I am the least of the apostles, who am not worthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God." So Paul, of course, had his past in the rearview mirror, as all of us have something in our past that we wish wasn't there, but it is. Paul was the same. He says, "I'm not worthy to be called an apostle because of what I did." Verse 10, "But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was in me." So Paul's life had turned around after his dramatic encounter and after Christ's revelation to him, and he was going a different direction with a different mindset and different actions. And here he attributes that to God's grace in his life, making it possible to transform and to change and to move in a different way. Let's go next to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians 6, and we'll begin in verse 1. So this is coming right on the heels of chapter 5. And in chapter 5, we are urged to become a new creation and ambassadors for Christ in what Paul calls a ministry of reconciliation. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 1, Paul writes, "We then, as workers together with him, also plead with you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, in an acceptable time I have heard you, and in the day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." And we might extend that for those whom God is calling now. We know that God calls everyone in the appropriate time. For those whom God has called now, the day of salvation, as Paul writes here, is now. The words "in vain" in this verse mean to no purpose or for no reason. So Paul is saying, don't receive the grace of God to no purpose. Don't let it fulfill nothing in your life. Make use of it. Finally, then, let's go to Galatians chapter 2 with these three verses. Galatians chapter 2, and I'm going to read verse 21 from the New Living Translation. Galatians 2, verse 21 from the New Living Translation. Paul writes, "I do not treat the grace of God as meaningless, for if keeping the law could make us right with God, then there was no need for Christ to die." So he's talking about, again, that sufficiency that we often try to have within ourselves and the reality that if we were capable, if we were able to earn, then there would be no need for God's grace that comes through Christ's death. And again, he summarizes in the beginning of that statement, "I do not treat the grace of God as meaningless." These two passages from Paul's letters highlight, the last two verses that we read, highlight the two primary ways that we can miss out on God's grace. And neither of them have anything to do with our spiritual ability to earn God's favor. First, we might choose for whatever reason to opt out of a relationship with God and thus simply not be eligible to receive his grace because we are not in a relationship with him. And second, we might nominally stay in the relationship but try to remain self-reliant and decline to accept God's grace in place of our own sufficiency. The really fantastic news is nothing can force us to choose either of these paths that would cause us to miss out on God's grace. And likewise, nothing can prevent us from choosing to accept his remarkable grace. We are free to embrace it and through it to become members of his family. As the author of Hebrews encourages us to do earlier in the letter as well as in the verse where we started. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4, starting in verse 14, where the author writes, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are," so he fully understands the temptations that we experience, "yet without sin." Verse 16, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Again, it is freely available, and we are free to embrace it and to experience its benefits. Let's conclude with a statement from Jesus Christ that conveys this desire that God has for us. Let's go to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23. Matthew 23, and we'll read verse 37, and this is coming at a conclusion of a point in the flow, in the story flow, where Jesus was rebuking the scribes and the Pharisees for the many ways that they rejected them. So, of course, we know throughout the narrative of the Gospels, Jesus had many encounters with both the scribes and the Pharisees, and those were typically adversarial encounters to some degree. And in most of chapter 23, Jesus is rebuking them in various ways for the ways that they failed to accept him and actively rejected him. Verse 37, Jesus states, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together." Language very similar, very resonant with what we read in Micah 4. "I wanted to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." you were not willing. Jesus does not say that they weren't capable or that they weren't worthy, but that they weren't willing. What he's describing here is a group of people who failed to benefit from God's grace, not because they couldn't earn it, but because they missed it. They missed it. The opportunity was there in front of them, and they chose to opt out. God wants us. He wants you to be in his kingdom. The only thing that can prevent us from being there is a choice, not to accept his invitation and the grace that makes it possible. As the second verse of song number 105 in our hymnal, Ambassadors for Christ, states, as fellow workers with him, it's the day of our salvation. So let us not receive the grace of God in vain.